Sherlock Holmes was a past master in the art of putting a humble witness at his ease, and very soon, in the privacy of Godfrey Staunton's abandoned room, he had extracted all that the porter had to tell. The visitor of the night before was not a gentleman, neither was he a working man. He was simply what the porter described as a medium-looking chap, a man of 50. Beard grizzled, pale face, quietly dressed. He seemed himself to be agitated. The porter had observed his hand trembling when he had held out the note. Godfrey Staunton had crammed the note into his pocket. Staunton had not shaken hands with the man in the hall. They had exchanged a few sentences, of which the porter had only distinguished the one word, time. Then they had hurried off in the manner described. It was just 10:30 by the hall clock. "Let me see," said Holmes, seating himself on Staunton's bed. "You are the day porter, are you not?"
"Yes, sir. I go off duty at 11."
"The night porter saw nothing, I suppose?"
"No, sir. One theatre party came in late, no one else."
"Were you on duty all day yesterday?"
"Yes, sir."
"Did you take any message to Mr. Staunton?"
"Yes, sir. One telegram."
"Ah, that's interesting. What o'clock was this?"
"About 6.
"Where was Mr. Staunton when he received it?"
"Here, in this room."
"Were you present when he opened it?"
"Yes, sir. I waited to see if there was an answer."
"Well, was there?"
"Yes, sir. He wrote an answer."
"Did you take it?"
"No, he took it himself."
"But he wrote it in your presence?"
"Yes, sir. I was standing by the door, and he with his back turned at that table. When he had written it, he said, 'All right, porter, I will take this myself.'"
"What did he write it with?"
"A pen, sir."
"Was the telegraphic form one of these on the table?"
"Yes, sir, it was the top one."
Holmes rose. Taking the forms, he carried them over to the window and carefully examined that which was uppermost. "It is a pity he did not write in pencil," said he, throwing them down again with a shrug of disappointment. "As you have no doubt frequently observed, Watson, the impression usually goes through, a fact which has dissolved many a happy marriage. However, I can find no trace here. I rejoice, however, to perceive that he wrote with a broad-pointed quill pen, and I can hardly doubt that we will find some impression upon this blotting-pad." "Ah, yes, surely this is the very thing." He tore off a strip of the blotting-paper and turned towards us the following hieroglyphic. Cyril Overton was much excited. "Hold it to the glass," he cried. "That is unnecessary," said Holmes. "The paper is thin, and the reverse will give the message. Here it is." He turned it over, and we read, "So that is the tail end of the telegram which Godfrey Staunton dispatched within a few hours of his disappearance. There are at least 6 words of the message which have escaped us, but what remains, 'Stand by us, for God's sake,' proves that this young man saw a formidable danger which approached him, and from which someone else could protect him. Us, mark you, another person was involved. Who should it be but the pale-faced, bearded man who seemed himself in so nervous a state? What, then, is the connection between Godfrey Staunton and the bearded man? And what is the third source from which each of them sought for help against pressing danger? Our inquiry has already narrowed down to that." "We have only to find to whom the telegram was addressed," I suggested. "Exactly, my dear Watson. Your reflection, though profound, had already crossed my mind. But I dare say it may have come to your notice that, counterfoil of another man's message, there may be some disinclination on the part of the officials to oblige you. There is so much red tape in these matters. However, I have no doubt that, with a little delicacy and finesse, the end may be attained. Meanwhile, I should like in your presence, Mr. Overton, to go through these papers which have been left upon the table." There were a number of letters, bills, and notebooks which Holmes turned over and examined with quick, nervous fingers and darting, penetrating eyes. "Nothing here," he said at last. "By the way, I suppose your friend was a healthy young fellow, nothing amiss with him?" "Sound as a bell." "Have you ever known him ill?" "Not a day. He has been laid up with a hack, and once he slipped his kneecap, but that was nothing." "Perhaps he was not so strong as you suppose. I should think he may have had some secret trouble.
With your assent, I will put one or two of these papers in my pocket, in case they should bear upon our future inquiry."
"One moment," cried a querulous voice, and we looked up to find a queer little old man jerking and twitching in the doorway. He was dressed in rusty black, with a very broad-brimmed top hat and a loose white necktie, the whole effect being that of a very rustic parson or of an undertaker's mute. Yet, in spite of his shabby and even absurd appearance, his voice had a sharp crackle, and his manner a quick intensity which commanded attention.
"Who are you, sir, and by what right do you touch this gentleman's papers?" he asked.
"I'm a private detective, and I am endeavouring to explain his disappearance."
"Oh, you are you? And who instructed you, eh?"
"This gentleman, Mr. Staunton's friend, was referred to me by Scotland Yard."
"Who are you, sir?"
"I'm Cyril Overton."
"Then it is you who sent me a telegram. My name is Lord Mount James. I came round as quickly as the Bayswater bus would bring me. So you have instructed a detective?"
"Yes, sir."
"And are you prepared to meet the cost?"
"I have no doubt, sir, that my friend Godfrey, when we find him, will be prepared to do that."
"But if he is never found, eh? Answer me that."
"In that case, no doubt his family—"
"Nothing of the sort, sir," screamed the little man. "Don't look to me for a penny. Not a penny. You understand that, Mr. Detective. I am all the family that this young man has got, and I tell you that I'm not responsible. If he has any expectations, it is due to the fact that I have never wasted money, and I do not propose to begin to do so now. As to those papers with which you are making so free, I may tell you that in case there should be anything of any value among them, you will be held strictly to account for what you do with them."
"Very good, sir," said Sherlock Holmes. "May I ask, in the meanwhile, whether you have yourself any theory to account for this young man's disappearance?"
"No, sir, I have not. He's big enough and old enough to look after himself, and if he's so foolish as to lose himself, I entirely refuse to accept the responsibility of hunting for him."
"I quite understand your position," said Holmes, with a mischievous twinkle in his eyes. "Perhaps you don't quite understand mine. Godfrey Staunton appears to have been a poor man. If he has been kidnapped, it could not have been for anything which he himself possesses. The fame of your wealth has gone abroad, Lord Mount James, and it is entirely possible that a gang of thieves have secured your nephew in order to gain from him some information as to your house, your habits, and your treasure." The face of our unpleasant little visitor turned as white as his neckcloth.
"Heavens, sir, what an idea! I never thought of such villainy. What inhuman rogues there are in the world! But Godfrey is a fine lad, a staunch lad. Nothing would induce him to give his old uncle away. I'll have the plate moved over to the bank this evening. In the meantime, spare no pains, Mr. Detective. I beg you to leave no stone unturned to bring him safely back. As to money, well, so far as a fiver or even a tenner goes, you can always look to me."
Even in his chastened frame of mind, the noble miser could give us no information which could help us, for he knew little of the private life of his nephew. Our only clue lay in the truncated telegram, and with a copy of this in his hand, Holmes set forth to find a second link for his chain.